Good morning and welcome to Talking About California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host this morning. I'm director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center on the coast. This morning's guest, and our last and very fitting guest in this series, is Professor Richard Walker, professor of geography at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Walker's work is focused on economic geography, regional development, capitalism and politics, cities and urbanism. He's the author of many important books, including The Capitalist Imperative by Blackwell. He recently published a book on the history of California's agricultural system, The Conquest of Bread, 150 Years of Agribusiness in California, New Press. His most recent book is The Country in the City, The Greening of the San Francisco Bay Area, University of Washington Press. It narrates the many stories of land preservation, saving the bay, and fighting toxics that have made this a global bastion of environmentalism. I should add here that I have to leave out many of Professor Walker's accomplishments, but will tell you that he's been the chair of the Geography Department at the university, he's been the chair of the California Studies Association, and the chair of California Studies Center at Berkeley. And finally, can I call you Dick? Are you there, Dick?
Yes, I'm very much here.
And finally, Dick loves the life of a teacher, he tells us, an advisor, and is proud of his many former students teaching around the country. Finally, he's an activist in public affairs and on the campus, and not on his CV, he tells us he takes great joy in gardening, singing, and parenting. Good morning, Dick, and thanks very much for coming and taking the time to talk with us this morning and guaranteeing that our conclusion to the series will be a high note.
Okay. Well, thanks for that. Thanks for the nice introduction.
Good. Well, it's very difficult with you to know where to begin because of all the work that you do. But let me start with the California economy. You sent me an article, California Shrugged, Fountainhead of the Great Recession. Can we begin by asking, how about this? Isn't this just another, though deeper, cyclical crisis? And don't we just have to wait it out, no matter how painful? And then maybe connected to that, why do we focus on California?
Well, it isn't just any old recession that's hit the United States and the world. This is a really big one, and it's a really big one because it had such a financial blow-up, and it's pretty well known. There's some good studies now of the history of financial crises, and not every recession is accompanied by the kind of financial bubble we had in the 2000s, and when that goes, there's so much overhang of excess debt that has to be written down, and it kind of distortions of the economy that it's very hard to pull out of these things. And this one is going to take, it already is taking a very long time. So it's more like the Great Depression in that regard, and that's why it's rightly called the Great Recession. It's really the biggest thing since the 1930s. Now, as for California, we play a really big role in bringing this on. And that's because, well, it's for several reasons, which I'm happy to enumerate, but it's mostly because California is such a big and important part of the American economy, but also because it was the center of the whirlwind of the housing crisis and the financial, the sort of bad financial practices of subprime mortgages that led us down the garden path.
So you're saying California actually played a role in this world crisis, then?
Oh, absolutely. People think it's all Wall Street. And Wall Street is the kind of the pivot point because everything, all the debt flowed through Wall Street. They're the ones that were pushing out so much of the, you know, making it possible through their secondary mortgage and tertiary mortgage markets, selling this stuff around the world, but the money then flowed back to the actual mortgage issuers. And those guys, those banks and savings and loan and mortgage companies, were heavily concentrated in California. And that's because for two reasons. One is we've had a lot of specialists in those kind of funny money operations for years now. It goes all the way back to the 1980s. And secondly, California had the most expensive, most exaggerated housing market in the United States, and one of the most in the world, really.
And what happened?
Well, what happened was that people couldn't pay. And this was, mortgages were being pushed out to unsuspecting borrowers, or perhaps suspecting borrowers who weren't, you know, didn't want to read the fine print, who were way over their head in debt. And when the piper came, they couldn't pay. And a lot of these mortgages, what they're called subprimes, there's a variety of these things. And they're very often very large because the houses were so expensive in this bubbled-up housing market. And the people, the working class of California, their incomes weren't going anywhere. So in order to buy those houses, they had to go deeply in debt. And then a lot of these were funny mortgages like adjustable rate, where you can get in very easily. It's kind of the Roach Motel of mortgages. You get in, but you can't get out because it looks like your monthly payments are going to be low at first, but then as interest rates go up, your payments balloon, and then you're screwed.
And why, well, housing prices are, you know, high relatively still up here, and of course in the Bay Area in particular, but why the Central Valley? How did that come to be such a focal point for this problem?
Yeah, it's interesting because along the coast, you'd say, especially in the favored places like San Francisco or Berkeley, you'd say, oh, well, yeah, the housing crisis was bad, but wasn't that bad. But if you go out to the interior counties out in the Central Valley or in Southern California, you go out to Riverside, San Bernardino County, it's absolute disaster. I mean, it's really Great Depression kind of conditions out there, given the unemployment rates and given the mortgage, the foreclosures. I mean, you had foreclosure rates in many of those towns, like Stockton or Modesto, that are 40 to 50%, and decline in prices that were 40 to 50%. Whereas closer to the coast, it might be 20. You know, the average in the U.S. is about 30%. But it's a big differences between the more prosperous coastal areas, which, you know, are bolstered by the tech boom, and the interior valley, where most of the people were working in agriculture or in construction. That is, they were actually building the houses in a sense that they and their fellow workers were trying to buy. And these were people who were essentially being chased out of the coastal areas by the high prices. The prices were so exaggerated that the working class, and especially young workers of color, because that is who the working class is in California now, overwhelmingly, at least in Southern California and much of Central California, they had to go to the interior to try and get their dream house, try and buy into the American dream. And that's when they got snookered by the mortgage companies and got themselves in trouble and now have lost their homes.
So we're hearing a lot about austerity these days, including projections of an end to austerity coming from Europe. But have we had our own kind of austerity here in California? It hardly seems like there's been much of a bailout for the people you're talking about.
Well, you know, there was the massive bailout of the banks, so the banks have not suffered austerity particularly. People who lost their homes have sure suffered austerity. But what it means in particular in California is the cut in government spending. The recession, you know, with the slow recovery, as they call it, out of this recession, which is, you know, barely inching along. I mean, it's barely keeping up with the growth of population. That is, the job creation is barely keeping up. But in California and in many other states, but especially California, the real problem is massive cuts at local and state government, and that means lots of layoffs. I mean, tens of thousands of people laid off from government, including, by the way, schools, the universities, the colleges, and so on. So that has been extremely depressive. So while we had a bit of a stimulus from Obama, which was helpful, went to some infrastructure, some of it went at first to teachers and all, the state and local governments have been playing little Herbert Hoovers and cutting, cutting, cutting. And that's exactly the wrong thing to do in the face of a massive depression, particularly in the United States, where government as a percentage of the national income is not that high. So there's really plenty of room and plenty of need for the government to do more things, to spend more on schools, to spend more on infrastructure, which is rotting, and so on. So what we really needed in this recession was a little New Deal, not a little Herbert Hoover, but we've gotten the latter and not the former.
And could you have a little New Deal on a statewide basis? Isn't there a particular problem for the states?
Well, yeah, it's very hard to do that because states are generally limited to having a balanced budget. And the key, in a recession, as the great economist Keynes showed in the 1930s, is you have to have deficit spending to make up for the collapse of spending by consumers and by investors, by capitalists. The consumers, of course, consumer debt had ballooned up. People were spending beyond their means because of all this mortgage money and borrowing on their houses and so on. When that collapsed, everybody is saving, trying to get their house in order. So consumer spending is really dead in the water in the United States. And then investors aren't spending either. That is, businesses see really not very much opportunity. You might be fooled by all this to-do about Facebook and so on, but overall, most of the companies are sitting on huge wads of money. It's a couple trillion dollars of money they don't know what to do with. And like Apple, they park it in the Cayman Islands or wherever, in Luxembourg, wherever they can to not pay taxes on it. But there's a lot of this cash sloshing around. So what Keynes said is, okay, in those kind of situations, the government has to make up the difference. And that's where we need stimulus spending instead of we're getting the opposite. Now, you asked me, could California do that? Well, California could do better. It's not through deficit spending, but through redistribution. And that means better taxes on the wealthy, on corporations, and on property, the property of the wealthy and the corporations. I'm not talking about, you know, granny's house. I'm talking about big landholdings that are vastly, commercial landholdings that are vastly under taxed in California because of Prop 13. So California needs to do a better job of collecting taxes from those who are sitting on extra money and then spending on things like schools and teachers that will both pump money into the economy and help the next generation get prepared for better jobs in a global economy.
So is this the sort of classic poverty amidst plenty syndrome then? Is it, California doesn't seem like a poor state, and yet responses to some of the things you're saying always seem to be that we just don't have the money.
Yeah, because that's become the mantra. I mean, it's just amazing how this ideology has risen back to the top. It's as if we never learned anything from the New Deal and the Great Depression and World War II, which is that you can spend, the U.S. government can spend beyond its means because it produces the dollars, and everybody wants dollars. Dollars are a strong currency. Everybody buys treasury bonds. So there's no problem of the U.S. government actually using deficit spending, creating dollars to pump life back into the economy. And this idea that we're all poor as church mice suddenly is just crazy. It's just backward. And indeed, it is shameful that the richest country on earth, which is still extremely rich despite all the problems of international competition and so on. I mean, we have lots of things we need to be doing. But there's a lot of money out there, and it's not being taxed, and it's not adequately. And, you know, I mean, Warren Buffett agrees with me. So this isn't exactly, a radical idea, really. But it sounds radical in an atmosphere where basically Herbert Hoover is the left wing of the left wing of the Republican Party if he were alive.
Well,
so California has to do better. We used to be a high tax effort state, and we're now a very modest tax effort state.
What does that mean, tax effort?
Well, tax effort has to do with tax as a percentage of your GDP, of your state income. And California is an extremely important, huge economy. You know, it's still one of the 10 largest economies in the world. And there's a lot of money circulating there that can be taxed. Now, I know from people, especially people maybe in Northern California, are going to think, oh, well, you know, we're not doing well. How could we be taxed more? And, of course, that's not the point. And I was very disappointed when Jerry Brown's tax measure included an increase in sales taxes, because those are taxes on ordinary people and their ordinary living, and we've got way more than we need. California's tax system has also become more regressive over time. So it's no wonder that a lot of average folk think, oh, yeah, this tax, you know, I'm anti-taxes because I'm getting hit with, you know, practically 10% on top of everything through sales tax. And people are rightly thinking, well, that's terrible. And that's not the kind of taxes we need. We need progressive taxes, more progressive taxes than we've got. And we need more tax effort than we're getting in order to raise the money to pump into places like Northern California, where the counties are all broke. You know, the counties can't raise the money. And they need to have a better tax base, but even more, you need the state and, of course, I might add the feds pumping money into places like that that have fiscal crises. I mean, the most important part of the Obama stimulus, which was defeated right out of the gates by the Republicans, was aid to states with fiscal crises. And that money would have come in and would have gone right down to counties, would have stopped all this madness of the deficit and the whacking away at the university, at the colleges, at health care, and everything that's been going on for the last 3 years, and would have allowed, you know, a lot of the basic services we all rely on to continue at a good level. And that would have pumped money into the economy. It would have actually served everybody. It's not like somehow this is lost money. When you pay money out for health care, it goes to employ people and then turn around and spend it and on local businesses. And this is exactly the kind of stimulus we need. And we have to stop. I mean, this austerity is just madness. It's just crazy. And yet, you know, that's what the dominant ideology in politics is right now.
So how do we get over this when your students ask you what's the sort of meaning of it all? What... How are we best to kind of understand this picture that you're giving us. It seems that mostly what we get is we listen to the morning or evening news and we get the ups and downs in the stock market. We get various reports on job figures. We get the campaign claims. Do we take a short-term view, a long-term view? Do we get involved? What kind of discussions do you have with people?
Oh, wow. Well, there's the hardest question of all. I mean, mostly I'm in the business of trying to cut through the fog of, you know, the obscurantism and the bogus ideas that tend to dominate our political discourse. And that's mostly what I do. What you can do about it? Wow. I mean, I always tell them there's a thousand things you can do. I mean, I spend a lot of my time fighting my university and its administrators about their wrong-headed ideas about public education, but there's so many other good groups out there. I mean, it's not hard to find things from the local to the national level, groups that you can work for, contribute to, that are, you know, fighting for better education spending, better health care system and healthcare spending and so on. So I don't think it's that far to look. I mean, but if we don't create a popular consciousness that something is seriously amiss, then we're in big trouble. And I think we have to start from the fact that so many people in California and around the country are hurting, and we need to take that seriously. That they're sick and they can't get the right health care, that they're disabled and they're not getting the support they need, that their schools don't have the books and the chalk and the teachers they need. You know, if people bang the drum enough about that stuff and we can get millions of people in California angry about this, we'll have a lot better chance of turning things around. But right now, it's so hard to get through because we're being told this is necessary austerity. You know, you have to do it. Government has to keep its house in order and la, 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 la. And taxes are bad. Government is bad. The private sector is the only good thing. I mean, this is just false. Government, there's a lot of good government can do. That doesn't mean you want it for everything. I mean, there's a lot of bad government can do. I personally think we live in a rather over-policed state these days. And I think government can do a lot of mischief. We have wars that are completely ridiculous and that are wasting billions and billions of dollars that could be used for the people of this country. So it's not like I think government's always good, but there are many good programs and support for the disabled or health care or our public schools that need our support, and we know that they do good. We have personal experience with that, and that's what we need to push for.
This is KZYX. Our program today is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Our guest today is Professor Richard Walker. He's a professor of geography at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of many important books. And Dick, I thought we would spend quite a bit of the rest of our time on your newest book, but maybe you could just give us a word about your book, The Conquest of Bread, 150 Years of Agribusiness in California, because that's an issue of really great interest up here in Mendocino County.
Oh, I'll bet. Well, you know, somebody once, this was an attempt to pull together kind of overview of this history, which hadn't been done really since Terry McWilliams wrote Factories in the Field around 1940. So there had been a number of good works in the meantime on this bit or that bit, but I wanted to try and capture the whole story. And partly, it's an amazing story because it's about one of the few places in the world that after 1850 was an entirely capitalist agriculture, an entire entirely business-like agrarian system. It always had pockets of family farms, but it was nothing like the Midwest or Pennsylvania or something. In the past, California was business agriculture by and large from the beginning. And the result of that is, like so many other sectors, whether it's, you know, was automobiles or electronics, this led California agribusiness to be incredibly dynamic and innovative on everything from mobilizing irrigation water for and chemical fertilizers and pesticides on the input side to processing, canning, and coming up with new kinds of processed foods and making an incredible work of selling food. I mean, California growers like Sunkist and Del Monte were some of the first to ever sell food as a product with brand names and so on. We also had, you know, the most modern grocery chains in the world in the middle of the 20th century and so on. So it's an amazing story of progress and industrialization. But it has some real downsides, and I was trying to tell that story as well. One is clearly the treatment of labor, that farm workers from very early on to today have been, you know, immigrants and migrants in general who've rolled through this system to keep cheap, you know, unorganized and pliant labor in the fields to do the work. Very hard work for the minimum. A second problem is what it's done to the land, the environmental effects of California agribusiness in terms of our mega water projects or our draining of all the wetlands. There used to be massive wetlands from the Delta through the southern San Joaquin, from Redding all the way down to Bakersfield. Most of which are long gone, and people don't remember what a well-watered state this was. And then there's the toxic cost of being the number one applicator of pesticides in the world. This place has been more drenched with pesticides than anywhere on Earth, and so on. And the result is, of course, the third thing. Criticism was about industrial food. You ended up with this kind of mass-produced, often tasteless, often toxic, and not nutritious food, which might have looked very big and pretty, like a big round orange or strawberry, but it's actually just pumped up with water and hybridized so that it grows fast and stays for a long time on the shelf, but doesn't taste for nothing. And what we've got in California for the last 30 years, and maybe this is a segue into other things, is we've had a revolt against the water projects with the defeat of the first Peripheral Canal, although that's like a zombie. It's coming back to visit us again. We've had one of the great environmental movements protesting in part against pesticides and other toxics. And we've got this tremendous alternative food movement in California now about organics and local supplied food and trying to eat more healthily. So the legacy of California agribusiness is all around us, both on the and what it's achieved as a business and also what it's created in terms of reaction and alternatives that Californians are trying to come up with and try and pursue.
Okay, well, thanks. And I guess we should now turn to what I think is your latest book. The award-winning book, The Country in the City, The Greening of the San Francisco Bay Area. It's published by the University of Washington Press. I think reading it, there's tons that's of special interest to people here on the North Coast, although it's all interesting, but readers will want to know that there are sections on forests and vineyards and on coastal access. I personally think it ought to be required reading for the citizens of Fort Bragg, where we have the developers lurking, looking at our local shoreline. But let me start off with this question. You know, opening up the book, we come to some maps. I think geographers, by definition, have to like maps. And we look at the Greater Bay Area, and there on, I think it's page 2, we see this remarkable shaded stretch of the coast, really, along West Marin. What happened there?
Well, of course, yeah, West Marin is perhaps the most famous part of this whole story. That, or perhaps Save the Bay. And now that goes back a very long way. It goes back to really the completion of the Golden Gate Bridge, which, you know, we're now having the 75th anniversary of. And a number of leading ladies of Marin County who formed the Marin Garden Club back in the 1930s, and then saw that suburbanization was going to be coming their way. And they created the Marin Conservation League, which has ever since been a leading light in trying to conserve land and get better planning in Marin. And they actually hired a planner, got the first county plan in California back in the 40s. And that plan is pretty much what you see on the ground today in Marin. And that plan set aside, the idea was to leave the west side of the county largely open space, recreational space, watershed lands around Mount Tam and so on. And then the eastern side of the county on the 101 corridor would be the part that would absorb development. But even there, to have things like green belts, breaks between the various towns to provide some relief from the endless slurbs that so characterized California sprawl. So they did an amazing thing. Now, there were many fights. We forget that in the 1950s and 60s, Marin was a very pro-development place. It had very powerful developers. The Board of Supervisors, the local Congress people and Assembly people were all pro-development. So while it sounds, you might think, oh, well, Marin, you know, it was always rich, and those people have a favored existence. So it's not surprising that they have all this beautiful land and so on. But actually, there were huge fights. This required major battles, as has all environmental protection in this country, in this area, in this state. And they succeeded. They succeeded in part because you had an elite there and you had the elite women who would fight. But they really had to fight. And actually, our view of Marin now is more based on the enrichment of the Bay Area since these fights were these battles were fought, because, you know, Marin was a much more kind of laid-back place. You know, think of the Grateful Dead and all hanging out in Mill Valley. It was not simply the gilded suburb that it is now. So the lesson I would say to take away from this is that to protect land, to leave beautiful areas, both for environmental reasons, for wildlife and so on, and for scenic beauty, and just for the pleasure of it, and for the joy of going out and hiking and going to the beach and fishing and whatever else you want to do. That if you want that kind of land, in the face of development pressures, you got to fight for it. You got to fight hard.
So we see development coming up, especially the 101 corridor. It seems like there's an awful lot of open space up here, but I wonder if, it isn't something that we ought to be concerned about, Greenbelt, the population. I don't know if it will continue at the rate it's been growing, but the population's growing a lot. You must know that the pressure in the counties that you count as Bay Area counties, you don't include Mendocino in that. But would you think it's an issue for the whole northern part of the extended Bay Area?
Oh, I think so. The Bay Area has now become a kind of mega metropolis. It's more like L.A. than we'd like to think. You know, it goes all the way to the Sierra foothills, goes all the way down to Hollister, and Salinas to the south, and I think in the north, you know, it definitely goes past Sonoma in County into Mendocino now, and then Lake County. So people up there often don't like to think of themselves as part of the Bay Area, and we could argue this endlessly about what that means, but you're starting to get the effects of this endless spreading out of this city. And you need to deal with this before it's too late. And when you go back and look at, like, the stories of Marin or San Mateo and Santa Clara County, Alameda County, you know, at times when those counties looked as open and as, you know, pristine and rural as Mendocino looks now, people started to think about the future and what the implications of untrammeled development would be. And because of those foresighted people, you still have some wonderful areas of the San Mateo Coast or the Berkeley and Oakland Hills that are in parks that are protected for the recreation and pleasure of everybody and not just for, you know, elite homes. And that's not what we need more of. We need open space. Yes, we need housing. You can have both, and you have to, but you can get much more housing and much more open space with some planning, with some forethought, with some rules of the game. And those have to be imposed before it's too late. Because, you know, once development values go up too much, it gets too urbanized, buying land for parks becomes prohibitive, and you'll never be able to do it. Putting restrictions on becomes much harder because the developers become more and more powerful the more numerous they are. And at the end of the day, if I'm not going on too long here, it does pay off. It pays off in unanticipated ways.
No, you're not going on too long at all, Dick. This is very interesting. We're talking about Professor Richard Walker's book, The Country and the City, The Greening of San Francisco, of the San Francisco Bay Area. And another chapter in the book, Dick, concerns the vineyards of the San Francisco Bay Area. Now, we've got vineyards in Mendocino as well. It seems like it's a very important story. Could you outline your take on the development of the Northern Bay Area, the Northern California vineyards?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's really an interesting story, because, and that's one of these payoff stories, that Napa back in the 1960s was under intense development pressure. Sonoma not so much yet, but Napa definitely. And when they were driving Highway, 25 up the middle. Is it 25? I probably got that wrong now. Oops. Up the middle of this freeway, up the middle of the Napa Valley. And suddenly people went, you know, looked around and said, what's happening here? And housing tracks were going up lickety-split. And that's when Dorothy Erskine and some of the vineyardists up in the Napa Valley said, wait a second, you know, we're just coming back from Prohibition. We're starting to make good wine, and now it's going to be paved over. So they got the county to vote for an agricultural protection zone. And it turns out that agricultural protection zone is what allowed Napa wines to flourish. You wouldn't have the Napa wine country without it. And we look, again, this is one of these cases where you look back, you look at things today and you say, oh, well, you know, the wine land is for vineyards is so valuable that it never, of course, they never would have paved it over. But in those days, it was iffy which way. It was very much up in the air which way it would go. And Napa wine wasn't so famous yet, and the vineyard land wasn't so valuable yet, and was with much more paved and housing tracts. So it took foresight to get this agricultural protection zone, which actually, you know, made possible the great success of Napa afterward. And that, of course, then spilled over into Sonoma. Sonoma had a much more interesting and longer battle, partly because Marin put such restrictions on. Some of the development started to squeeze up to Sonoma. And in any case, given the 101 corridor and the way people commute, Sonoma was taking off. So you had huge amount of development hitting in Sonoma. And it also had its own industrial base, economic base that was growing. And so then Sonoma had to go through these battles too. But it has, piece by piece, put in green lines around its towns, controls to protect vineyards, and then controls on vineyards. So the result is, again, Sonoma wine, North Coast wine, is very prosperous, as well as many other kinds of agriculture, by the way. Sonoma is much more diverse than Napa and has a lot of, like, our organic and farmers market providers down in the Bay Area. The farms are up there in Sonoma. So without a kind of environmental protection, there wouldn't have been the wine industry. Now, again, there's always a downside. And personally, I like wine. Personally, I think vineyards are pretty. Those kind of landscapes can be very beautiful. But vineyards can also be very industrial, monoculture. And there's been some real battles, rightfully so, over stripping off hillside oak forest, even redwood forest, to plant vineyards. That was a huge battle in Sonoma. And there are battles over pesticide use and fertilizer use and the impact on the watershed, on groundwater, and so on. That's been fought. And now methods there are improving. And even things like this reworking of the Napa River, which is quite amazing, where pushing back vineyards that had gone too close to the river to make a better flood control, because the Napa River has been a horrible flood threat for a long time. So you get the downside, and you got, like, new problems you have to deal with. But, you know, I think, again, what a lesson here is that people in the Bay Area, in the largest sense, have been very creative, very wise in many ways of dealing with these threats to the environment and keeping things a bit under control, getting better regulations, thinking through this stuff better, improving practices. And the result is the wine country is the single most important part of California agribusiness today is North Coast wine. It's the richest part. And it's fairly compatible with a lot of open space around Napa County, Sonoma County, where there are open space districts. They've done a pretty darn good job. So I think, you know, it's been a success story by and large.
This is KZYX. Our program today is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow, and I'm talking with Professor Richard Walker of the University of California at Berkeley. And we've been talking about his books. Right now, we're talking about his book, The Country and the City, The Greening of the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, we've been kind of skirting around the periphery of the Bay Area a bit so far. I wondered if we could turn, if you wouldn't mind turning to the city itself and talk about the idea of the greening of the city. What does that mean, and how does it work in the San Francisco Bay Area, in your experience?
Yeah, I think it's really important to realize that a lot of these conservation ideas, environmental ideas that have spread around the world, well, two things. Start in cities in general, and start in San Francisco and the Bay Area in particular. One of the reasons I wrote this book was not just as a local story, but as a lesson that this place had been so vital in the history of environmentalism, and it had been essentially left out of all the environmental histories I'd ever read. You know, they might feature John Muir or the Sierra Club, but they never attached it to a place. And as a geographer, I'm interested in places and what makes them tick and what makes them different. And I think it's particularly important that we recognize how special this place is, how special has been its whole culture of respect for nature and fighting for protection of the natural beauty of California, and also how, you know, brilliant and innovative, you know, we are. We're troublesome, we're politically active, we have this idea about the left coast, but it means something. The left coast doesn't just mean, say, you go join an Occupy movement, so that's fine if you do. It can also mean protecting the coast, and that these ideas have been bouncing around, echoing off each other, resonating with each other for a very long time. So I wanted to make it clear what a special place this was and how much had been achieved here. And then along with that, I wanted to undercut the kind of great man theory of history so that all attention goes to John Muir and David Brower and others of that ilk. Because what I found is they are simply the biggest fish swimming in a very busy sea, off a very productive reef, if you will, and in which you had activism from below supporting all their efforts, providing the membership, providing the people, the ordinary people who would go to city council meetings or board of supervisors to fight for this patch of redwoods or that river bank or whatever it might be that they cared about, and that these things, you know, added up to more than the sum of the parts. Really, the totality turned out to be much greater. And it just comes bubbling up from below, and it's really a part of it. It is a wonderful kind of positive lesson in what people can achieve. I think this place has changed the world. And we know that when we're talking about Apple. You know, and then we go and we need to say, oh, it's Steve Jobs. You know, he changed the world. Well, it wasn't just Steve Jobs. It's that whole culture of techno nerds in Silicon Valley, which also comes out of this long culture of the Bay Area of openness, innovation, allowing people to kind of try out whatever they think will work, and being really inventive and attracting creative people. Well, the same goes for environmentalism. And we've attracted those kind of people, we've supported those kind of people, and we've carried through their ideas, not through private corporations, but through organizations like Save the Bay or the Coastal Commission, you know, sometimes governmental organizations, through Save Mount Diablo or the Marine Conservation League or Committee for Green Foothills. These organizations, big and small, are all over here, all over the region. And they've kept this flame going, and they've done the dirty work. And then I'll just finish on one point that I found most intriguing about this, which was the role of women. That so much of the work and so much of the inspiration and the battle was carried by women, and still is in a lot of these organizations. And that, too, was part of the story that had never been told in formal, you know, national histories of environmentalism. Somehow, as usual, the women got left out. But here, as soon as you start looking at this base and looking at all the hundreds of movements and battles around the Bay Area over the years, it's all peopled by women and occasional guy.
Examples?
Oh, Dorothy Erskine, People for Open Space, Carolyn Livermore, the Marine Conservation League, I'm, of course, blanking.
Well, that's
I'm getting to be an old guy, you know. Pulling these names out of the hat is not as easy. It used to be Lenny Roberts of the Committee for Green Foothills, and so on and so on.
Well, that's great. And what about the, I don't know how new it is, but the urban gardening and the local mini parks and rooftop gardening and all of that that seems to be flourishing. Do you see that as connected, as going anywhere? What are your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, what we've achieved in the past in terms of open space or protected rivers or the bay, you know, that's great. And it gives us some important lessons in what you can do and what the wonderful results of that are, that we have a bay, that we don't look like L.A. because we have a bay and so on, or that we protected the coast.
You're fading out a bit, Dick. We got a few more minutes here. Hang in there.
But today, I think, you know, the problems are different. With global climate change, with these mega cities, we have a whole set of new problems we have to face, and there are people, you know, down there working at the bottom, maybe you aren't always visible, sometimes are, who are working on urban farming, on permeable hardscapes, on green roofs and solar power, and a thousand other things that can change our cities, can make our cities livable and viable in the 21st century, and not just repeat the same old, energy-intensive, carbon-intensive, sprawling cities of the past. Well, we got a lot of work to do, but I'm bolstered by the fact there's so much going on locally, so many young people who are still totally active in this, as some of us old guys, you know, push off into the sunset. So I do have a lot of hope for the future. And certainly, I think, you know, I wrote this book right after George Bush was elected in a moment of depression, thinking about what was a positive story I knew about political success of people I respected who'd gotten results that mattered to me. And so the greening of this area was very important. But I think we can look again to this area if we could just get some of the albatrosses of national politics off of our backs. I think it would be amazing what the people of the Bay Area and Northern California in general could do to make this a better city and a better world.
And one last thing, a few minutes left. What about education? How does that fit in? I know it's, you know, been your life, but how does education and the schools right up to the university, how would you say that fits in? I know it's important. Listeners to this series will know that we started off with a couple of your colleagues, one of your students, Gray Brecken, and then your student, Julie Guthman. It seems to me there are tremendous contributions being made in the area. And we've had some students, many students from up here who come down and do environmental politics and geography at the university. What's the outlook in your mind for the contribution of education in this whole area, and as you say, in the era of global warming?
Well, we already see that our schools around here do a much better job than anywhere in the country in terms of inculcating children with a sense of the value of nature and kind of sustainability. Those things, you find that's been going on for at least a generation around here. And that's one of the reasons we have so many young college kind of college leavers or other young people who are willing to get into organic farming or alternative urban design or whatever it might be. So I do think we already have a record. The sad thing, going back to what I was talking about earlier on, is that the austerity package of California has just devastated our schools. And I mean, the stories in Northern California of kids who can't get buses to school and so on are just heartrending. And it's just unacceptable. It's absolutely unacceptable. We have to be investing in our young. We have to be, you know, and there's nothing magical about it. There's all this palaver about, you know, I mean, well, if it's a charter school, and if it's a, and if we have more tests, and if we do this and that, you know, kind of trick to adjust the schools, and everything will be well, but it won't. When I was young, growing up in California, we had one of the greatest public school systems in the country, and we also spent a lot per pupil. We're now at the bottom of the list. We're down in Mississippi and Arkansas, and that's what you're going to get, is a Mississippi-Arkansas kind of culture. If you don't invest in your young, if you don't invest in K through 12 schools, in community colleges, all the way up, because they're all essential. They all rise and fall together. And we see that at the university. You see that if the kids aren't well-educated below, they're not prepared for college. Now, people may say, well, okay, we have to focus on our elementary schools because those are the little kids. Couldn't agree more. In fact, we need public preschools like the French do. I mean, we're really, really backward as far as that goes. But it goes all the way through. Our high schools, of course, so many of our high schools are failing the kids, tremendous dropout rates, just abysmal dropout rates. But it goes all the way up to the highest levels. And I know people, you know, I'm speaking as a UC professor, and you could say, well, that's very elitist and so on. The amazing thing about California is that we created not just the greatest public education system in the world, and this is widely acknowledged around the world, it's well known, that for the kids, we also created the world's greatest public university. And that's an astounding accomplishment, to be able to do everything. And, you know, people say, well, you can't do everything. You can't afford it. But we can. We have a very rich state. It's still a world center of innovation, of entertainment, of, well, military technology, if you like that sort of thing, of agriculture and so on. We have the money. It's a question of purpose and priorities and getting out of these crazy ideas that the rich need more money and getting greater equality again and having a government that has the money to pay for the things that ordinary people absolutely require. And one of those is education. There's just no way out of it. Nothing's going to work. You can't have a citizen, an informed democratic citizenry without education. You know, that's been said since Thomas Jefferson, and it's correct. And you also can't have the payoff of a well-educated workforce, all those creative people that are going to create the next generation of wondrous things in California, if you don't educate our children.
Well, thanks very much, Dick. We're running out of time, I'm very sorry to say, but thank you again. As expected, it's been a splendid conclusion to our series. And, you know, in this last segment, I would like to thank again all those people who've contributed, and I'd like to thank our listeners. And in particular, I'd like to thank the staff here at KZYX and Mary Agner, the program director, who have helped me so much. If you have any comments or suggestions about the series, please let me know. You can reach me at cwinslow@berkeley.edu. Dick, really appreciate it. Thanks very much for coming on the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Cal. Thanks very much for having me.
And thank you, listeners, and who knows when we'll talk again. Good morning. Bye-bye.